Renee, how did the music of Burl Ives and Peter, Paul, and Mary influence you at an early age?
You know, with Burl Ives, there was always the story. There seemed to always be, you know, stories in the albums that my dad had of Burl Ives. And the same thing with Peter, Paul, and Mary. They often sang Celtic tunes that, like, would arrange it their way, sound more American folk. But they would sing Celtic tunes, protest songs. It just kind of broadened my view of the world, I think, at a very young age, where I could imagine there was this tune that they had called The Rising of the Moon. And I could imagine these two disparate bands of people fighting to, you know, for their own nationality and their nationalism. I don't know. It just seemed to open my mind outside of the house I lived in and the things that I learned in school as well. I was like a separate and parallel education going on, musically speaking. And of course, when I would hear Burl Ives, I'd try to sound like him, you know, get that as much as a child could, you know, that certain graveliness in his voice. I try to get sound like that and learn how to harmonize, learn all the harmony parts for Peter, Paul, and Mary. My brothers and sister and I would all sing those songs. All of us did. I was the only one that carried it to an extreme, but the rest of them, you know, we all joined in.
Could you tell me about your kinship with Eartha Kitt?
Well, you know, it's funny you brought that up, because I watched those TV programs too and had no idea who she was in the popular culture. I just knew that here was this black woman, well, this colored woman, on TV talking to these white people like she didn't, you know, didn't care what she said to them. Whereas my experience in growing up in Jim Crow, with Jim Crow laws on the books in Virginia, my experience was nobody I knew that looked like me ever talked to white people like that. And so I remember being fascinated and also a little frightened, thinking, is she going to get in trouble? You know, and when you're a kid, you don't know how to distinguish between fact and fantasy. I think there probably is a cat woman around here, you know, Batman and all that. But I do remember being fascinated and at the same time a little afraid for her. And it wasn't until years later, after I started singing, that my manager, who had googoffs of Eartha Kitt's music, he was telling me about her. And he said she used to be Catwoman. And I said, what? That was Eartha Kitt? So one day we had a chance to see her live in New York. And I was fascinated all over again. But singing the songs that we ended up playing on the CD, I Want to Be Evil, you try singing those songs over and over and over again, and your personality is going to change. Because you cannot sing a song like I Want to Be Evil, just stand there. You know, you have to embody the lyrics of the song. So my personality really did change, and I had to have a heart-to-heart talk with my husband after we recorded that CD, because I could feel this, something was set loose. Some moorings within me were set loose a little bit. And it all worked out for the best.
I'm told you had a 23-year career in banking.
Well, I really didn't have a 23-year career in banking. Okay. I had worked at the bank about 7 years. I started off as a teller and just got, every time I would see a position on the board to apply for, I would do that until I got to the point of training customer service reps. But prior to my working at the bank, one time I added up how many different jobs I've had. And I have done everything from cleaning offices, cleaning people's homes. I worked at McDonald's. I worked at a grocery store as a cashier. I delivered newspapers. I worked for the telephone company. I just did whatever it took to help my husband make ends meet while trying to be as much of a full-time mom as possible. But all those jobs were part-time jobs until I took the job at the bank. It was full-time. After the boys, my sons were, you know, probably late elementary school, early junior high, something like that. It was good work. I learned a lot about myself in the training of customer service. I realized, hey, I know how to distill information, like big chunks of information, into bite-sized pieces for people to understand. I learned that, and I didn't know that about myself. So it's been really rewarding transferring that ability from the bank into music, like when I do master classes and workshops and so forth. It's extremely rewarding, and sometimes, Chris, sometimes I seem to get more joy from that than I do from singing, which I never thought I would say. But it's just so rewarding when you see the students take what you just said, apply it to their singing, and the song comes out of them in a whole different way. You see the surprise and the delight on their faces, you know. So... yeah. It suits me.
How did the film Lady Sings the Blues impact your life?
Well, I was 17, and I had never heard of Billie Holiday. I was only going to see the movie because Diana Ross and Billy Dee Williams were in it. I didn't know any of the other actors. Well, maybe I knew Richard Pryor. Probably knew about him at 17, yeah. But I had no idea what this jazz was supposed to be. And, you know, I sat there in the theater, went by myself, sat there in the theater and was just blown away. Especially, not so much with the story of Billie Holiday, but, you know, they had jazz all throughout it. And hearing these jazz musicians play, that's what really impacted me, was the instrumental stuff that was going on in between scenes or in the background, you know. I would see people, I didn't know what it was called at the time, but see musicians soloing, you know, or maybe it would be a big band. And I just had no idea that this existed. So after the movie was over, I went to the music store and bought the book of the soundtrack, Lady Sings the Blues. I still have it upstairs in my on my bookshelf. It's, you know, old as hell and the cover's coming off, but I still have that book. And that was the beginning. I took the book home and I'd had a couple of years of piano lessons as a kid and, you know, turned to some of the songs that had impacted me the most, like the song Lady Sings the Blues. I just thought that was, I loved the melody line, and I learned how to play maybe half of the tune in the book. I was singing in an R&B band at the time and had met my future husband in that band. And so I took some of the music that I thought maybe we could play. I took some of it to the band, and we ended up doing couple of tunes. We did Strange Fruit from there, and Violets for Your Furs, which they probably hated, but I loved it.
Could you tell me more about the song Red Shoes? I'm told the song came together during a JVC jazz festival in Paris some years back.
It was on a Sunday, the day after the gig. And we had that Sunday off and flew home on Monday. So I was just walking the streets of Paris and looking in the window shops and seeing the beautiful fashions. I saw this pair of red, high-heeled leather shoes, and the store was closed. And I know I stood there drooling and trying to figure out, how can I get these shoes? I would have bought them right there on the spot, but I couldn't. And came back to the States and thought, well, how hard can it be to find a pair of red, high-heeled leather shoes? Well, there are plenty around, but none of them look like that pair. There was just something about the way they were designed, just a plain pump. And I was sick. I thought, I'm never going to get those shoes. Oh, no. And started thinking about how much fun it would be to, you know, if I had gotten those shoes, my whole life would have been different. You know, I would have met a different person. Just my whole life would have changed just because I had those shoes on. So I wrote a song about it with my sister's personality in mind, because she's much more, she fits that description in that song much more than I do. And there were a couple of little sayings that she had that I put in the song with her permission. So it was a lot of fun writing that song. And I like how it, you know, it's got this real driving 6/8 time. And then it, every once in a while, it abruptly turns into this 3/4 time lilting. Da dee dee da dee da. Dee dee da. Really soft. And then it goes back to the to this hard driving 6/8. Anyway, it's fun. A lot of fun to sing. And somebody said, you should have put that on Sound of Red. But I think we had, I think we have enough songs on Sound of Red, enough brand new tunes, that it was all right.
I really enjoyed listening to Lift Every Voice and Sing, Star Spangled Banner. Some people didn't like it that much a few years ago, according to what I've heard, but that's their own stuff being triggered.
Yeah. Well, I ended up singing Lift Every Voice and Sing to the melody of Star Spangled Banner during Denver Mayor's State of the City address. And some people thought it was inappropriate. And then there was this huge flash in the pan that lasted 3 or 4 days, long enough for them to interview then presidential candidate Barack Obama about what I had done. But I continued to get emails and phone calls about it for at least a year and a half, which was a real eye-opener for me. Because when you're an artist, it's easy to get tunnel vision and only see things your way, with this creative bent and this free-flowing of ideas and pushing the envelope, crossing the line. And I learned that while I would never stop doing that, but I did learn that it has a bigger impact on people than I would have thought. And so it led to some very nice conversations with folks from across the across the country and in some foreign countries as well, who took courage by the fact that I did that in trying to maybe speak out about some injustices in their own country. That really surprised me. And then, you know, of course, I got emails that were quite challenging. But I made sure that I read every single email because I realized the responsibility that's incumbent upon a musician when you decide to take something that is considered sacred and refashion it. You're going to stir up, or as the word you use, trigger. You're going to stir up and trigger people with their emotions. And as an artist, I feel responsible to accept that feedback as if it's part of a bigger conversation, you know. I don't think it's right to stir up those emotions and then just walk off the stage or just remain silent. You know, a hit and run, so to speak. I would much rather stand there and speak with them about how they were impacted. Anything other than that would feel irresponsible. That's just me. I'm not saying anybody else has to do it, but that's how I feel.
Why did you cover Strange Meadow Lark by Dave Brubeck?
My favorite song by him.
Ah.
I've always loved that tune. And after we recorded it, I was listening to Dave Brubeck being interviewed on Fresh Air. But what's her name? What's the interview's name?
Terry Gross.
I was listening to him being interviewed by her, and she asked him, "What of all the songs you've written, what is your favorite song?" And he hesitated for just a few minutes, and then he said, "Strange Meadow Lark." And I was like, yes! You know, because I love that song. I love the melody, first of all. It just goes everywhere. And usually it's done as a ballad. It's gorgeous as a ballad. I wanted to swing it, though, because I could hear it being, you know, just totally taking off, you know, levitating, if we could swing it really, really hard, which in the recording is definitely what we do. Live also, that's what we do. But then I found out that his wife, Iona?
Yes, Iona.
She wrote the lyrics. She writes lyrics, or wrote lyrics to a lot of his tunes. And, when I found that out, I just had to do it. I just had to. It's a lot of fun to play, I'll tell you that much.
Why is your band called Experiment in Truth?
Our band is called Experiment in Truth because I trust these musicians that I've been playing with for quite some time. I trust the truth of their own individual musicality. And I trust the musicality that we bring to any given song as a group, the truthfulness of it. You know, one of the things that when I hire a musician, I say to them, look, I understand that there are going to be songs and things that you do, that you've practiced and rehearsed with your instrument, that you're going to put into songs. I'm going to ask you to avoid doing that just because it's something you practiced, and respond more to what's happening in the moment. If it ends up being something you practiced, all well and good. But you can tell if someone is going through their laundry list. You can tell. So I don't want the laundry list. You know, what's true for you right now, playing this song, may not be true for you the next time we play it. So it is an experiment. I mean, that is a little unnerving to tell somebody. But it's what I want, and I don't mind it sounding like, oh, what's going to happen next? I don't mind that. Some people don't like that, but I thrive on that. I like for them to push me to be completely honest at all times, because it's so easy, Chris, to lapse into these grooves, musical grooves, and I don't mean that in the hip sense. I mean like getting stuck in a rut and doing the song the same way over and over. So that's why it's called, the group is called Experiment in Truth. It might sound, is it high sounding, or I hope not. I hope it's not too frou-frou. But that's what it feels like, that we are experimenting with our truths individually and as a group.
I'd like to know a little bit more about the song from the last album, Joy of Jazz.
Joy of Jazz, that was inspired by my first and only trip so far to Africa. We were invited to participate in the Joy of Jazz Festival in Johannesburg. And, when we got there, you know, the people were so nice. I was just blown away by their kindness. So much so that I asked someone who lived there, hey, are you guys nice like this all the time? Or is this just like because of the festival, like, you know, and you're just being a good, showing us good hospitality? And she said, oh, no, this is the way we are all the time, because Papa Mandela taught us to use the principles of Ubuntu in all of our dealings with everyone. And someone later explained to me that Ubuntu could be illustrated by saying, imagine there is a tree over a couple of hundred feet away, and there's candy at the bottom of the tree, and there's a group of kids playing together, and you tell the kids, hey, there's candy at the bottom of that tree, the first one over there gets to have it, and they all join hands and run over to the tree together. But that is the spirit of Ubuntu. So I was deeply touched by that. It seemed like such a simple principle. But I was very, very moved by that. And was so happy to be there that while I was there, the song, the melody came to my mind, the whole groove of the song, you know. And someone said to me, well, that's not West African music. And I was like, I'm not trying to play West African music. I'm just writing a song called Joy of Jazz. And this is the vibe and the melody, and, you know, I'm not trying to turn it into something it ain't. This is just what came to me. So, it makes me feel so happy every time we play it. It's powerful. And I like to use the opportunity, if I can, if I'm close enough to the audience, I like to use that song as an opportunity to dance with someone. People want to dance, you know, but they hold back. In this country, they just hold back. You can see them, the smile on their face, their bodies are moving, they're energized, and they're so self-conscious. And I think because singing and dancing, or playing music and dancing, has become something to observe rather than to participate in. And that is a shame. So usually when I start dancing with one person, then I think people feel free to go ahead and get up and dance. You know, I'm begging them almost on my knees, like, come on, you guys. Come on and dance. Well, it works most of the time, sometimes not, but that's okay. I try to take it all in stride.